CliffCentral.com. Yeah, well, it's Wednesday morning. We've got Alan Committee with us, which is terrific. It's good to see him in his natural habitat full of DVDs. And Simphiwe Mtetwa in the studio in Johannesburg. And we are waiting for your comments as well in the comments section. You can join us on YouTube or on Instagram or on Facebook or on Twitter. It's all streaming live. Okay, let's get stuck into a few things. We've got, as I mentioned, Gilly Apta joining us a little bit later on. Alan, you said that things are getting back to normal in terms of theaters opening and all the rest. What are you doing at the moment in terms of your own entertainment? I mean, like, have you been watching a lot of shows? Have you been getting out there?
Yes, I have, actually. I try to do that anyway. I think that's important. If we as artists are not supporting or watching stuff, I'm not sure how we can complain that the public isn't.
Yeah, it would be a real hypocrisy if you sat at home going, no one supports the arts except me.
It's quite weird how many people don't support. You know, there are a lot of people who don't go and watch stuff. I also think it's part of what we do. Listen, comics are quite good in this country. I think they tend to... because one of the ways to get better is to watch others and learn from the good and the bad.
Right.
So I've been seeing a lot of stuff. And then just in terms of my own entertainment, I have actually spent a lot of time in cinema. I do like going to the cinema. I still like that. And during lockdown, or certainly in the easier parts of lockdown, it's been fantastic because it's often been just me in that cinema. In fact, I can throw my pop all over the floor and eat it off the floor. That's how clean it is. It's fantastic.
Now I know who went into that cinema before me and made it look like someone had had a temper tantrum or an apoplectic fit in there. It was you.
Correct. Exactly. And then I did start watching, which has been on my watch list for a while, is The Offer, which is it's based on the making of The Godfather, which I'm really loving. I'm kind of binge-watched 4 or 5 episodes the other day. It's a great period in cinematic history, of course, in the early 60s. Some brilliant films were made, but this is a really wonderful recreation of it, and I'm enjoying every moment.
Yeah, there's some good series out at the moment. A lot of what we do on the show is everybody kind of says, you've got to watch this series, and then we all kind of help each other out with the next one. You know, there's always something great going on that if you don't hear from someone you trust, you just don't bother to figure it out, and then you end up watching
shit. It's not even about... Do you know what series? It's about which platform. Do you know this platform?
Yeah.
And then people, I don't know about that platform. Never mind all the stuff that's on the platform.
And all these subscriptions that we suddenly are supposed to have. You know, if you you need to be a millionaire just to be able to afford all the different streaming platforms.
Yeah. And then the choice that you have. I will look at, I think I've got, I vaguely and quickly counted down on my Netflix watch list. I think it's about 800 hours of stuff that I've got to get through.
Sure.
Then you've got Amazon, blah, blah, blah. And you look at all of that, you spend 3 minutes going through everything that's available, and then you end up watching The Chase. Or, you know, really pathetic, you know, or a mindless quiz show that'll just take you out of your own depression for 25 minutes.
Yeah, Simphiwe, what are you watching?
Yeah. I haven't watched anything like in terms of like series. The last good series that I watched, and I think I loved it, was Anatomy of a Scandal. Just because it blurred on the consent lines, like that consent has a gray area. And they kind of delve into that to say, sometimes consent is not as black as and white as we think it is. Mm. So that was the last great like series I binged, and I was like, ooh, this is... Everyone needs to watch it. Watch that and you'll be good. And there's drama.
Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. Very, very good. So here's a little compliment for Vanessa, who we just had on. Rose says, I've been listening for many years, but this is my first comment. Keep up the amazing program. Thanks, Gareth. Well, it's nice that you finally joined us, Rose. Ethan says, did the film about a young Tony Soprano ever come out? I'm not sure about that. Does anybody know?
I think it did. I don't think it got a lot of time on our cinemas because it was seen as quite an arty thing, but I think you can find it on some streaming services. Forget the name of it. And it's quite good.
So listen, I can ask you this because you will remember A, and B, you might have something to say about him, but Barry Rongner died like two weekends ago. Now, I explained this to a friend of mine. He had no idea who Barry Rongner was. And then I spoke to someone else about it. She's 26. She was like, I don't know who that is. And
I don't know either.
I know you don't know who he was. And I thought, like, maybe Alan would be able to say something about Barry, because he used to be an institution. This guy was – he could – first of all, he could make or break a movie, which was incredible. He was like our Rogers and – what are they – what did that – what was the Roger and Ebert, yeah. There were these two guys in America who used to review movies, and if they said a movie was good – everybody in America would go and see it. And if they said a movie was shit, no one would go and see it. So they had that kind of power. And remember in those days, you know, he got to see previews of movies. And so he would warn us in advance, this is a piece of shit. And I mean, you didn't always agree. Like, I never really liked the movies that Barry liked, but a lot of people listened to him. And he was an influential writer. He was the host of TV shows. I mean, he was probably the first multimedia kind of star in the country, even though – it wasn't a big 100%. Thing, you know?
It was extraordinary, and I think you and I'm 48, it's that era, we used to, he used to write for the Sunday Times.
Yes.
He had a kind of editorial. He was our kind of Stephen Fry as well, because besides all his great skills, he was unbelievably erudite. He had a knowledge across huge areas, and he somehow was able to interlace a little bit of philosophy with pop culture.
He's a clever guy.
With music. A lovely guy.
And his column was called Spit and Polish with Barry Bonner. And Barry, Spit and Polish, which was in the Sunday Times. But he was a bit like Stephen Fry. Yeah, I think that's a good comparison. I mean, he
and he made a point as well about whether you agreed with him or not in terms of his reviews particularly. He did offer a kind of basis. So if you knew that you tended not to agree, at least you then knew, well, this is a movie I should see or not.
Right.
Because he gave us consistency. That was his thing. He was unbelievable. He had a consistent lens through which he reviewed everything. And he was also very brilliantly generous to young performers in a sense of offering them space. He would go and see theatre works or young filmmakers' works and reference them. So, you know, he did all the right things. He was a really lovely guy.
Yeah, I wonder, though, if there's anybody who's doing that kind of work in the arts at the moment, because, you know, theatre needs so many moving parts to work. And I'll admit that I've kind of fallen off the wagon. I've never been one of those people who liked musicals. I don't like one act or one man plays. It's not really my thing. I mean, sure. I like everyone else in the country, I have seen Defending the Caveman. I mean, I saw that years ago, and I think it was with Tim Plewman. And I have no doubt that it continues to enthrall audiences, and that the shows that you're involved in, like Love Factually now, are great crowd pleasers. And I'm not really the target market here, because I'm a grumpy, miserable son of a bitch. And I also, I don't even like Marvel movies. So, you know, what chance you can't get me out of the house is the point. Like, So I'm not going, it's no reflection on theater necessarily, but to get me out of the house, it has to be a really good reason. And I think that theater needs people like Barry and people like you and people who are multi-talented, who can do comedy, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, you know, these kinds of things. And across a broad spectrum to attract the interest from a crowd. And it's hard because you don't want to live in a society where people feel that they are shame. We must support the arts. They must do it because they want to.
Absolutely. And it is getting harder. There is so much noise out there in the world now. You know, what used to be, when we were growing up, there was two newspapers that you wanted to read. There was maybe one or two radio stations you wanted to listen to, and maybe three channels that you could watch.
Yeah.
Well, now it's multi-screen, multi-platform.
Right.
So many books. Everyone's talking. Everyone's got a podcast. So to make it stand out, you've got to do something special. I would argue that theater, when done well, it's not often done well, but when done well, is literally life transformative, because it has that energy that is specific to that evening. It should, when done well, move you in a way that will make you come back. But to get people to the theatre is one of the questions that has, you know, been bandied around now for hundreds of years, not just in this country, around all communities and
for all time. I mean, this is one of the most ancient forms of entertainment, and it does. Like, if it hits you, it hits you right in the heart, you know,
and it in a good way. Yeah, it doesn't have to be. You don't have to cry or feel like your life is. you can just laugh yourself into a transformative state, literally. So something live, it's the thing of going to watch a live concert or listening to a CD or something on a music platform. You know, there is the difference of engaging and being present when your favorite musician is doing the thing in front of you in a way that you won't feel when you're sitting at home and listening to it on your earphones. But, yeah, it's, as you say, getting people out of the house. And, of course, post-pandemic, even I, as a performer, go,
yeah, I know. We've become lazy. Loud, yeah. And I mean, people are too lazy to even go to the office in some places. They're like, oh, no. No, really. I mean, this is a big problem in America at the moment. People are quitting their jobs because their boss has the temerity to ask them to actually come into the office. They're like, oh, well, then I just won't come in. Really, it's happening. So let me ask you two some advice. My brother suggested the other day that we do like a family board game thing. I love my family. I get on with them very well. I don't need to necessarily be forced to play board games with them, but this is something he wants to do, so I'm going to go along with it. And it'll also be good. Like he's got two kids, and I see that like for them to learn how to play games and be a good sport and all that shit. And to see people interacting in a fun way isn't necessarily good. I mean, when we were kids, we used to play board games with our folks. And we used to, my dad used to cheat all the time. And that was part of the fun is that he'd say, I'm not cheating. Meanwhile, he was hiding a whole lot of Monopoly money behind his back or whatever. And I mean, it was so obvious. But I'm kind of confused as to what games we might be playing. What are the board games that are even available at the moment? What do people do? Is there anyone who's listening to us now who plays these board games? What would you suggest we start with? How do I stop myself from getting bored? And you know, what are the shortcuts and the clues here? Because I don't know where to start. I haven't played a board game in ages.
Yeah, well, Gareth, you'll be glad to know that, like, Wordle is being turned into a board game. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we'll have it in South Africa anytime soon, but, hey, that might be a new board game that you want to check out in a few months. But Wordle is being turned into a board game.
See, I didn't
but
know
I
that.
Think how you go, I think how you should go about it is get a whole lot of tequila. You guys are adults.
Oh
just get
God.
Drunk.
No, but
don't even try. And then you play like 30 seconds, a bit tipsy, but everyone gets competitive. That's like the only real board game that a lot of people
30
enjoy.
Seconds is always a win.
30 seconds is great.
Yeah.
And it reveals a lot about the people playing it and under pressure. It's fun. I had a friend, she was quite stuck up and constricted. She was a partner of friends of ours, and we were playing 30 seconds, and she got unbelievably stressed out, and she was looking at the name. She went, she's a sanctimonious bitch! And it turns out she was talking about Mother Teresa.
Angry, eh? Wow.
Yes, So, you know, we learn things about each other.
All right. There are a couple of things, though, that I have to put in here as caveats. First of all, I like to win, so I'm gonna have to hold back on my desire to win above all else because it doesn't make you a fun person to play games with. Second of all, that is particularly pronounced in a board game called Risk, which again I haven't played for a long time, but Risk is basically about world domination. You have armies, you fight with the dice, the roll of the dice, and you take over territories and all of that stuff. I take risks super seriously, and I'm not very much fun to play with. So I think that one is out of the question. Monopoly is fun because it also teaches you about basic, like, economics. You know,
that
you buy a
problem. Long.
It's long. That's the problem. And
long. Monopoly doesn't end. That game does not end. Like, everyone just needs to be like, I'm done. Like, Monopoly?
So
you'd
people
like...
Yep.
What's the one where you make up a definition? Balderdash. Balderdash is quite fun.
Oh, that's where you make up a definition for words.
Yes, yes.
I haven't played that
in ages. And you can't do it. As the game loosens up, people become a bit sillier with it, and that's where it becomes quite fun.
Steve says Monopoly is a test of character. I think that's about right. You know, and this proves to you, like, someone who is a shit person before they have money will be a shit person when they have money, and vice versa if you're a good person, you know?
Yeah.
It's not necessarily a board game. What's this Heads Up?
That'll oh yeah, that's nice cool. That's head. Fun.
That's yeah. Yes. That's a cool game to play with people. I think that might be a winner. It's not
Melissa,
as competitive, but
Melissa says Cards Against Humanity, which is hilarious. But again, if we're playing with the kids, they won't get it. So that's definitely that's one for the adults.
I was taught backgammon for the first time about a month ago.
Oh yeah,
quite fun. Yeah, have you played?
No, I've seen people playing it, like old Greek men in coffee shops.
Chess for me, I was playing chess with a friend the other day, and he said to me, "Shall we make this interesting?" I said, "Yes," and so we stopped playing chess. It was better that way. But backgammon strikes me as slightly more kind of intriguing, the strategy, and it's quicker and easier than chess as well.
Hey, I decided stupidly to take on a friend of mine at chess just in a, we were kind of, we've got like 20 minutes to kill. Let's see how this goes. We were waiting at a party or something, and he just destroyed me in like 4 moves, and I suddenly realized, like, if you don't practice that game, there's just no way. It's not like getting on a bicycle and, oh, no, I can ride this bike. You are screwed if you haven't practiced chess for a long time. You have to be on top of that. 30 Seconds and Monopoly are my favorite, says Snai. I'm just impressed people play board games. I didn't even know people were. So it's not just my brother.
Forgot the other game.
What's that?
The one that you build. Why am I forgetting
Jenga.
It?
It's Jenga.
Yes, that's also a good one. That will get the heart beating.
You pull the blocks out and you try not to collapse the tower, that thing. That's not a bad one. Parallel Parking says, backgammon is fantastic for showing how you really are in life, and it gives you the opportunity to expand and change your tendencies. What do you mean? What do you mean? It's moving little things around.
So what I discovered and was taught by the person who plays it was very good, is that it really is about how attacking or defensive are you. And it reflects kind of the kind of person you are, whether it's in the business world or even in your personal life. Do you go on the defensive? When do you take the opportunities to attack? And essentially the four blocks, all the business happens in the two middle blocks. Where both partners are trying to, because once you, well, it's no point if you haven't played it, but once you pass each other, you can't go back, as it were. So it's quite an interesting thing about making choices and decisions and when to attack and when not to.
So a lot of good suggestions coming in here. I quite like the idea of Uno, because the kids already play Uno, but they play a version of Uno that my sister and her boyfriend taught them, where if you put down like a +8 and +4 and then the poor person has to pick up like a whole bunch of cards, you must go wah so that it's me. It's like so they call it wah Uno. So the kids already know how to play that, and it's quite funny because then you see them like being mean to each other and going, "Wah, you just have to pick up 20." The other one's like, "Oh." So that's quite fun. I like that idea. Cranium? I don't know about Cranium. I've never played Cranium. Anyone play Go?
No.
I don't even know what that is. Sorry. Jenga is another suggestion to go with you. Simpiwe and... Ndogozo says he's proud. He destroyed his girlfriend in chess the other day. She refuses to play with me now. Yeah, that's the problem.
Yeah, you know fun. You know fun. You know fun. No.
Daniel says, here in Dubai, board game cafes are quite popular. It's crazy to see the range of table games out there. That's awesome. Yeah, you see, this stuff does happen. In Greece, that's all they do is play backgammon, says Rob. Yeah, it's true. There's a game called Buraplas. If you can still get it. No, I don't believe you. Buraplas. That's excellent. All right, so suddenly we've awoken all the people who love board games. This is cool. Okay, so I think we must do this. I must change my attitude. I'm going to do it, and it's going to be fun.
We should just call it like a games night, and that's all you guys get up to. And
I don't know.
Have like a bunch of games.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it's always going to work. Like sometimes you're going to have a shitty game. Sometimes someone's not going to be a good sport, but that's part of it, right?
Yeah.
So let's do it.
Yes. Exactly.
Yes. And it's good to switch things up. So if the one is like taking forever, if you have Monopoly as like the starter, then you do something else.
Oh my God. No, you can't play more than one. You'll be there all night. I don't want to spend that time. I see enough of my family. Thank you very much. Dominoes. Who still does dominoes? Vanessa says Domino's is a good time, but playing the coloured way causes more rifts in the family. Okay, so that's probably not a good way. I don't know what the coloured way of playing Domino's is. Someone fill me in. Vanessa, come on, help us there. Robin says, no screaming and put your thinking caps on. Okay, Robin sounds like very headmistress-like in this.
Whoa, Jerry, rules. All right,
no, there will be no screaming, and you will put your thinking caps on, children.
Yeah, okay. So, look, I needed to ask you that because I don't know where to start with this stuff, and now I can at least go in prepared. I've got some ideas now. Monopoly after smoking some weed is a lot of fun, says Ndogozo. I don't know. Yeah.
The game drags. Doesn't it drag? No.
You know who's a big board game guy is Rich Mulholland. And there are all kinds of really, really involved and complicated and very thoughtful, novel, interactive board games that have come out recently. I don't know anything about that world. And, I mean, all these games that we've spoken about this morning are more or less within kind of my ambit. I know what they are. I've played them at least once, some of them anyway. The ones that I didn't know, I said I don't know. But there are this range of board games that he plays with his family as well. But it's incredible. Some of them are hugely intricate and involve like the kind of stuff that you'd probably need a computer for, but they have cards and they have, you know, little moving things, and the board is very complex, and you go up and down and left and right and all kinds of things there. And I've got to get him to explain this. He's invited me to a board game night, and I think I was busy that week or whatever, so I didn't get to go to it. Now he lives in Cape Town, so I'll have to go down there to play. And I don't think I would fly to Cape Town for a board game, but it sounds to me like it's really, really interesting. And he swears it's the best way to entertain the family. Do you play charades?
Charades is fun.
I used to, yeah, with friends. So we don't have like a board games. We have more like a games night with my friends every so often. And then it just ends up turning into a drinking match. But
yeah, exactly.
We do set up we do set up like a string of games to play. So we'll do beer pong, we'll do 30 seconds, we'll do Jenga, as I mentioned, and then
beer pong first, the rest are not going to work.
Yeah, then the rest don't really matter.
I mean, we're learning how to do this thing correctly, guys.
Right.
But like, that's what we get up to in terms of, like, instead of not going to the clubs, just hanging out with friends. And it's always a good time. Like, it's always a good time. So, yeah, and we spend hours but 30 seconds is the one. It will end friendships. 30 seconds. If you can't describe, don't be part of my team.
Well, you see, you're competitive like me. So if I don't have the best partner, or if I have someone who's not, because you get people who might not have a good general knowledge, but they're in sync, right?
Yeah.
They can read each other's minds. They're on the same sense of humor. They've got the same level of kind of intuition. Those people can win even if they don't know a damn thing, because they'll use sounds like, and they'll use, you know.
They're annoying. Kind
of, they'll act.
They're annoying me.
Yeah, I know.
And more fun is when two friends give each other the wrong clues and get the right answer. Capital of India, Uruguay, yes, and it is Uruguay. Then that's just what we go, what's the point of this game
now? But you know what's worse is when they're like, we had it yesterday. That sounds that I don't like.
Yeah. Huh? Yeah. It's a personal story, and we're like, oh, how the hell did you get to that?
What's that? Yeah, they're like, oh, it's my favorite movie. We don't know you. What's your favorite movie? And then the one person's like, oh, you know, like Troy. And they're like, girl.
There were a group of comedians playing once. I remember this. Mark Banks, we played 30 seconds, and Mark Banks got a clue. And his clue to us was, made lofts popular. And the answer was Anne Frank.
What a nasty thing to say. He's brilliant. He's an absolute. I mean, he's a lunatic, but he's brilliant.
He's a lunatic, a madman.
I would love to watch a game of 30 seconds between a whole bunch of comedians. I think that would be hilarious.
It does go to fantastic levels, which is
great. Yeah, look, the problem is often if you do some of these things with boring people, it's like anything, you know, if you're with the wrong people, it's a disaster.
Exactly.
That's true for going away on holiday. It's true for parties. Yeah. It's true for board games. It's true for dinners. It's true for everything. the wrong people. And there's sometimes this is another like skill that I think I'm getting better and better at is putting the right people together, because if you do develop that skill and if you work at it very consistently, you think about like I'm inviting these three guys and these three girls, and I think even though they don't know each other at all, I think they'll get along and it works. It's like, wow, look at that. That's working. That I like a lot. I love when you can see like people's they're laughing about the same things. There's a definite like connection out of nowhere. I love that. That's my favorite thing to see.
And I think the other thing as we get older is that you just want less drama in terms of, you know, when you're younger, you don't mind. It's quite interesting to have someone who's going to cause a rift or disrupt. But sometimes you want to go, I'm just going to have a good time. So I think particularly in work, when I'm casting shows now, there might be the absolute brilliant person that we all know can do this in his sleep or her sleep, but is hard work off stage. We're going to have to spend 10 months with him back. Actually, you know what? I'd rather go with a guy who's going to be okay, but he's a delight off stage and a pleasure to be around.
Group of people. So Nella says, if you want to die, get stuck in the lift with Mark Banks and Import Pops because they'll make you laugh to death. That's about right. So speaking of people who make us laugh and who make us feel good, here's Gilly up to. Hey, Gilly, how are you?
Hey, Gilly.
Listen, where in the world are you at the moment? Because you've been all over.
Say, when Alan was saying like he prefers comedians who aren't that good on stage but are fun backstage, I
that's why I got Gilly to come to Cape Town. She was tremendous. Wow. What a seat!
The comedy's already started. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm good. I've been to a lot of places.
Oh my God. you probably have more stamps in your passport than anyone else since COVID.
I do. Last night I was talking to some friends who told me they hadn't been on a plane in 3 years, and I have been on more planes in the last 2 years than I've been in my entire life. I think I
counted. Can I have your life, girl?
Yeah, I think I've been on like I've done 40 flights this year.
Jeez.
Wow.
Well done. That's amazing.
Yeah, I don't know if that's well done.
No, I think it is. I mean, you're probably so used to planes at the moment that you scratch a nest in the chairs and just fall asleep straight away.
Not at all. I haven't become any more accustomed to sleeping in discomfort. You'd be amazed at how my need for like total comfort and luxury at all times just never goes away. It never goes away.
Well, I mean,
I see people all around me. On planes, I see people all around me just fast asleep, and it makes me not only can I not sleep,
furious,
it makes me angry.
Yeah,
I just walk past and I'm like,
So listen, some of these places that you performed and some of these gigs that you were doing are pretty wild. I mean, I saw on your Instagram that you were at some incredible venues. You were on stage with some amazingly well-known people. I mean, it's really been a tour de force for you. Fantastic stuff.
Yeah, I've done a lot of stuff. I have like two or three tours that are booked, that are planned, and everything in between I'm kind of going on my own steam just to check out new comedy scenes, you know, checking out like what like that's what I did between the tour that I had in Canada, which was planned. I had a month and a half, and I thought, let me use that time to try and see new places, see where else it's possible for me to do comedy, just because I felt like I just need more access. I need access to more comedy. I need it to be more available to me. You know, in South Africa, our comedy scene is like very, very, I mean, it was small before COVID and now it's even smaller.
Yeah.
And it'll grow, but it's going to take a long time, and I need to talk about what's in there now.
This is what I think a lot of people don't realize about, you know, you and Alan and a lot of other very talented comics, is that you guys have to research a lot of the time too. Your research is actually watching other people. Do you climb on stage sometimes at a club when there's an open mic and just go for it to see what you can do?
That's all I do. What do you mean?
But I mean, like without any, you don't go to the place and decide there and then, is what I'm saying. You go there with the intention of going on stage. But have you ever been in the crowd and they've gone like, oh, okay, open mic, and you thought, let me just go for it, and you test out some material in them?
Yeah, I test out material all the time, but it's never like, I never go up there and just start talking randomly. Like, I never just start saying things I've never said before.
So you've got a plan. You've got a plan in your head every time.
I've got a plan, even if I develop that plan like 5 minutes before I go on stage. But it's a plan of jokes that I already have. It's never a plan like of things I've just invented.
Right.
Sometimes and often the first thing that comes out of my mouth will have been something that just occurred to me in the moment about the room or whatever's happening there and then. Everything else is a combination of like jokes that I've done before or that I've thought of before or stuff that I want to work on, you know, ideas. But I will have thought about it at some point, even if it's in the car.
So we got two comics for the price of one this morning. So it would be remiss of me to not ask you two about this because it's probably been the most successful stand-up special of the year so far is this Ricky Gervais one, which everyone's talking about. And I'm sure you've both seen it. And I just want to know what you think of where he is, what you think of that show, whether you think it's overhyped or whether you think it's absolutely brilliant. Because everyone's in awe of Ricky Gervais, even though he's pretty much doing what he did before. It's the same style. He hasn't changed at all. But he is saying some things that don't go down too well in some audiences. What do you guys actually think of him, and where do you think all of it's going? Because clearly breaking the rules is something that's going back into the world of comedy. And, you know, Dave Chappelle's broken a whole lot of rules. Ricky Gervais is too. This is part of what you guys do. You're social commentators. What do you make of it?
Well, I'm a huge fan of him as a writer. I loved all his TV stuff going, obviously, starting with The Office, but going into extras and all that. The man's incredible. I would suggest, humbly, that his stand-up stuff, I don't know that he's a great example of an excellent stand-up. He's a fine example of a good performer, and he's an excellent example of someone who has built such a strong comedy base because he has such a clear perspective and a consistent perspective that I think it's translated into a huge following who've accepted that whatever he's saying is fantastically funny. For me, I call it that high school syndrome. If you're funny in grade 8, by the time you get to matric, anything you say or do, we now just assume funny. You don't actually have to be funny anymore. We just go, oh, that's the funny guy. And he's at that point. So I would say this last stand-up special wasn't particularly strong as a well-written hour of material. There were lots of funny things in it. I would say it was a bit underdeveloped in the topics that he tried to cover. There were moments of great interest. You want to go, oh, well, mine that more, dig deeper. But having said that, who cares what you think?
He said this one thing about AIDS, and I was watching it on my laptop, and I actually had to get up. I started, like, choking. Because I thought, oh, you cannot possibly get away with that. He really did go into places that I don't think a lot of people wanted him to. And I love that he did. I mean, he's just fearless.
I don't know. I don't necessarily agree with Alan on the point of the – I absolutely think you're right. He does carry a lot of, like, cachet because of everything he's done. Totally agree with that. So that everything he does, like you say, is like – you know, whatever. But and I've absolutely loved him as a stand-up, funnily enough, until this last one. I also just did not think it was as good. I didn't think it was on par with any of the others. And I loved the one that came before it. I mean, I was mad about it. Like, I thought it was truly excellent. And this one, when I watched it, exactly what you say, I felt like I saw the machine working.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
For me, it's actually quite easy to get lost sometimes in the very good. When people do a job that's so good, even I can get lost in it. But yeah. I couldn't get lost in this. I saw all the mechanics and I was like, oh, no, you were like, they're going to pay me now to do this special. I'm just going to go with what's going on. Like, that's what it felt like.
Right.
But, you know, the man's brilliant and he's fairly prolific. He's already working his next one. I saw Humanity live in London and it was watching it live as well. I mean, it was, as you say, it was an hour that didn't feel like work. You couldn't see the mechanics of it, and it kept surprising you with material.
Yeah.
But the thing I love about our industry is that there's a million roads to Rome, and there's not one way. So you don't have to always shock. You don't have to. You can shock us by not shocking us as well. And so, you know, he fits nicely into a bigger cog, and he does it very well, you know.
I can tell you, like, I have now not only performed all over the world, I've watched stand-up all over the world. Mm-hmm. And, like, I've watched the most incredible acts from, you know, in New York, in London, in L.A., and they all have something. There's no one style that you can go, oh, this style is funnier than anything else. Or this way of being, or being more shocking is funny, or being like some of the funniest things I heard were from the most like subdued people you've ever seen. Not even trying to shock anyone. Can barely stand.
I love that when there's someone really nervous and kind of quiet and sort of ferrety, and they suddenly come up with a line, and you think, Jesus, where did that come from? It's amazing the contrast.
Oh, I was at the Comedy Cellar. There's a guy who goes on at the Comedy Cellar who's like, he talks, you have to like concentrate so hard because he's speaking so slowly, and he's Swedish, and he's like, I do not know why I am a stand-up comedian. And that's how you listen to him talk for like 20 minutes.
Oh, wow.
Hilarious. The jokes are hilarious. You know?
Do you do you ever find that you're performing for the other comics and not for the audience sometimes? You have to watch that.
Yeah.
If you know someone who's also a fellow comic, because I mean, like for example, it's bound to happen, right? You put a bunch of bodybuilders in a room and they all like showing off to each other. You put a bunch of scientists in the room; they're all trying to compete for who's the cleverest. It happens. This is what people do. Yeah. So does that happen with you guys too when you're at a show? Obviously, then someone is going to be on the stage at any given time, and you know that those people in the audience. But does it also happen socially? And can it be very annoying if it does?
I can tell you, like, it was a huge breakthrough in my stand-up when I realized that what I was doing was performing for comedians. Because what happens is when you start every night, that's who you are with every night. And it plays on your mind to understand that you are performing to comedians every night. And so I realized that that's what I was doing. And when I stopped doing it, it changed. It brought me back to what I was doing when I first, like, initially set foot on that stage. Because you don't realize that it's happening to you. You start becoming part of a social group, and you start to please who's standing at the back of the room. And you're embarrassed if it doesn't work out in front of them.
Right.
And then you quickly realize, oh, actually, the only people I have a responsibility to in this room is the audience.
Yeah, 100%. I think I started my comedy career in a very different way, in that it was always through theatre and solo shows. So I didn't have that pleasure. I did very little comedy clubs or comedy lineups. Now that I've been around for a bit, there is a pleasure in knowing that you can, as well as take, as Gilly suggests, take care of the audience and play to them. You can. So I host the Cape Town Funny Festival most years, and this year it was lovely to have Tats, who you've just toured Australia with, in the wings, and know that there were things that I would do just for him, because we've just spoken about it, and you know, and he would do likewise. So, but your first prerogative and obligation is to the audience, making sure that they're looked after.
At Alan's show in December, we had this audience that were just terrible. We're a terrible audience, and I think it was Nick.
What is a terrible? Just explain what a terrible audience is. It's sour.
A terrible audience,
just
you know,
sour people.
It's rare that I blame the audience, but I'll tell you. I think for me, a terrible audience is a conservative audience who are afraid to laugh. That's what it is for me. So it's this weird thing that happens when a group of people become like sit together. They form.
So they're just like, that's funny.
I can't tell you. It's a weird, weird phenomenon. When you put a group of people in a room together, they suddenly become one entity. And you don't know who that entity is going to be until you set foot in front of them and open your mouth. And then they tell you who they are all of a sudden. I used to think, like, you can take a cold audience from being very cold to being a great audience. I think that's rare. I think sometimes the audience that's in front of you is the audience that's in front of you, and it's that personality. It's like meeting a person, and you have to deal with the person that's in front of you. And sometimes that person is not a great person.
I mean, I've always had a problem with these people who go out, and Alan, this also goes for the theater. People who go out and they're like, oh, I don't want to be here. Try and entertain me. You know, it's like this attitude of, and they really only do this with comedy. Some people arrive at the theater with a bad attitude, but really
sometimes you've got 100 people and 50 people are like, 51 of those people have that attitude. It tips over into being a bad audience because it makes everybody else uncomfortable.
No, sure. I listened to Bill Maher talking about this with somebody on a podcast the other day, and he was saying, I mean, he's also got to that stage that I think Alan was talking about with Ricky, where you've been around so long that people just assume that you're brilliant and funny, even if you're not always. And I mean, Bill's also, you know, he's very political and he's extremely clever, and people know him, and he's got the celebrity edge, which I think helps enormous amount in Hollywood and in America generally. But Bill said he does blame the audience sometimes. Because he said he knows. He's tested that same joke out on like 15 different audiences, and then the one audience went off. He says, it's fucking you. It's not me.
Yeah.
It's you.
Yeah. I could never blame the audience like for a long time. I didn't think I was good enough yet. There were too many variables in my performance to be able to then blame the audience.
Right.
And then at some point, I will say, in the last year, I've started to go, oh, I can tell when it's not a good audience, you know.
When I do theatre runs of a comedy show, and we'll play 7 weeks in Cape Town, 10 weeks in Joburg. So by the end of that run, you've done 85 performances. You have a very good idea after 70 performances what works, what doesn't. And then you can go, 8 of the 10 variables are consistent. One of the two that isn't is the audience, and that's changing. So actually, maybe it is the audience in this case. But, you know, so, when I talked, I found that out quickly, Gilly, that any group of people bigger than 4 or 5 will take on a personality of the strongest person in that group. So the over-curious kid, or the kid that's disrupting, or the very slow kids, or the very quiet kids, will make the class that personality. And you have to deal with it, because it becomes one entity. And what you did try and do is isolate the people who aren't that entity and try and get them to change the group dynamic.
And, you know, but Alan is an absolute master at doing that. If you've never gotten to see Alan, you absolutely have to go watch this. You've never seen such masterful handling of the audience almost all at the same time, and then individually somehow. It's like watching magic happen. Nice. It's unbelievable.
That's a nice thing to say. Yeah, I like that. But I think maybe you hinted at where that comes from, is like when you used to be a teacher. So you learn, if you can get children to behave, you can get adults to behave.
That's the truth.
Yonder says, ooh, Gilly, great seeing you live here, and you just made it back from down under. So you were in Oz, you were in Canada, you were in the UK.
Where have you not been?
I was in Canada. Yeah, I was in London, I was in New York, I was in LA, then I was in Canada, then I came back here, then I went to Australia, now I'm back here.
So which country? So because this is something I love to joke about with friends of mine who have emigrated, and who doesn't have someone who's emigrated to one of those countries, if not all of them. Which country is the most rule-obsessed? Is it Canada or Australia at the moment? Which one do you think has more?
That's a really good question. I will say this. I thought it was Canada. That everybody's very civil and incredibly polite.
Oh, yeah.
But you know what? You know what's taught me a lot about the world is my airport experience.
Right.
And I have to tell you, I've never had, if you know anything about travel right now, it's chaos. It's like people, it looks like a refugee crisis in every airport. That's what it looks like. It's like you just walk, you see people crying beside you. You're just trying to make it to a gate and like leave. You know, it's every man for himself. You're like, you're just fighting with somebody over liquids in your bag. It's chaos, okay? Like, I got spat out of a flight. A flight reversed. It reversed. I thought I was going to my destination. They were like, no, sorry. And they brought us back to the terminal, kicked us out into Montreal airport, and that's where I spent my next 24 hours just in Montreal trying to figure out what to do with my life. So that is the experience that is happening right now. And I have never had a more pleasant airport experience than Australian airports. And I've been to about 5 or 6 of them in the last 2 weeks. And that tells me something about their ability to follow rules and to be organized.
Look,
they win.
I'm gonna scratch this because I know you guys will make fun of it anyway, so it's not gonna be a serious conversation. But I love South Africa for a number of reasons, and I'm not some kind of ridiculous patriot who's just, you know, sings the anthem and cheers for the Springboks. I don't care about that shit. But for me, South Africa is cool because there's exactly half of the kind of lawless Wild West anarchy craziness, lights go off, lights go on, government doesn't know what the fuck it's doing, that kind of stuff. And then there's a part of it that just works. Like, you can see, like, we're not Nigeria, right? People still drive on the right side of the road most of the time. We still kind of, you know, we're civil to each other. Most South Africans are kind of the normal social interactions are polite and friendly.
Yes.
You know, the poorest person in South Africa is, they're not aggressive and violent and horrible, and the rich people are not like thumbing their nose at the poor people and like spitting at them from their cars. It's still a civil society, and we still have some rules, but you don't have to follow those rules here. And I kind of like that mix. And I'm looking for a way to explain this to people who don't live in this country, who might be listening to us now. But in Australia and Canada, as I understand it, the rules help people to just be better and everything's on time and, you know, everybody does exactly what they should and there's huge levels of responsibility and personal accountability and the police do what they're there for and you can always trust the police and the government try to do the best job possible. It's just very cookie cutter and to me a bit bland. Doesn't excite me like South Africa does. There's so much opportunity here as a result of those gaps.
I hear you, okay. That's
those are the words. Whenever anybody goes, I hear you, you're like, nah, they don't. They fucking disagree with everything I've just said.
unfortunately, it you don't get one without the other. So you don't get this like cool level of chaos where you can avoid, you know, like you can don't have to follow the rules without a lot of crime.
Sure.
And I can tell you, like, after being like in load shedding and then not having load shedding, I'm like, you know what? I'll follow the rules. It's fine.
Really?
I'll follow some rules.
Had enough. Yeah. Well, that's probably why a lot of people decide eventually, hey, I'm going to move to this place instead of this place because I'd rather deal with rules than inefficiencies.
I'll tell you some crazy phenomenon, though, that I saw when I was in LA and New York and Canada is an insane amount of homeless people in these first world countries.
Yeah.
And not just homeless people, like crack zombies of the apocalypse.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Like, everywhere you look, especially in Canada, on all their streets, they have just, like, oaks, like, manic crazies, just, like, walking past you in the street. You have to, like, give them space and, like, walk around them. And at night, it's terrifying, especially in New York and L.A., especially in New York. It is at 3 a.m. in New York City. If you are in the subway, you are in a zombie fight for your life. That's what it is.
Really?
Yes. Yes.
God,
you you have to just watch out. There's some crazy person could push you onto the tracks. Sometimes they come at you, you have to like move out of their way.
Well,
it's wild.
We were joking. Ellen and Simpiwe and I were talking earlier about like where we would, which mall we would least like to be in or which one we'd most like to be in during a zombie apocalypse. But the way you've just described the New York subway, I think you actually had experience of that. Wild.
No, it's wild. A man came up to me. I was just standing there and he came up to me and he went, "You were killing in the courtroom." What?
Oh man. I've heard this from a lot of people who've been to especially San Francisco and LA. They say those are the two worst places for it. There's quite a lot of it on the West Coast in general, but New York
LA is crazy because it's like you just don't understand how so many people – you don't understand how you're in a first world country and you're
and
just being like this.
They're like living in tents street. And they're living under the highway underpasses and they
– Something that somebody told me is that a lot of the states, a lot of the like more conservative American states bus mentally unwell people to the liberal states because they don't want them on their streets. Or because a lot of the homeless people are related and mental health related, right? And so a lot of those states literally put those people on buses to get rid of them from their streets and send them to the liberal states. And the liberal states can't send them away, so they keep them. And that's how they end up on their streets. That's one.
That's what we – didn't we do that with when the 2010 World Cup was on? Then didn't we also bus away our homeless people to, like, Beaufort West and places like that?
Yes.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, that's not good, Gareth. No.
Yeah,
clear. It's business. You're heading out.
Liberal states, you know what I mean?
Well, I mean, also, let's admit this freely, that those liberal states are also attractive propositions to the homeless people because they know they can camp wherever they want. They can fill the parks up. And obviously, places like L.A. are just like, because of Hollywood and because of the glitz and glamour and the entertainment business, it just attracts a lot of crazy people. I mean, how many people do you know in entertainment who are insane?
All of them,
exactly. The only difference is that none of us are like shooting up heroin at the same time as we're being insane and practicing our craft. Well, I speak for me. I'm not going to speak for you, Alan. Alan's always been a famous heroin addict.
Not before 8 o'clock on a Wednesday. I have some responsibility.
But it's such a weird juxtaposition, right, Gilly? I mean, you're in these amazing first world countries with these glass skyscrapers and these incredible infrastructures and public transport, and yet you've got these huge swathes of human homeless people just like lying around, looking for drugs, kind of pushing each other around and sleeping out in the street in the middle of, I mean, now it's summer, so obviously they can, but I mean, you feel sorry for those people in winter, especially.
I don't know how those people survive a Canadian winter. I mean, I was walking past, there's like a, what I realized was like some kind of methadone clinic. I don't know if that's the right term, but like a clinic where they wean people off drugs. And I just saw a man literally just standing in the street, like looking for a vein in his leg. And I was like, what? This is like insane. This is insane, you know? And everything else, the people are so polite, you know? I was like, this is obviously like a big, like, blight on their cities, you know?
Is this a good time to push spirulina and just say that it is very healthy?
Shooting up at the just some spirulina quickly. Shit. Oh my God.
Yes, and then you walk around and you like start talking to people about being a vegan, you know?
Listen, is it, I mean, you've said this twice, but is it true that Canadians are all so polite and so friendly? Because this is also a stereotype. I mean, you know what they say about us. God alone knows what they say about us all over the world. I've heard nice things, like South Africans are very hardworking. But, I mean, are Canadians all really that that beige? Are they all just so friendly and polite?
Not really. Listen. It was just my experience in, like, shows, you know, and performances is, like, people, you find out a lot about who people are from shows. And we had, like, we had this moment in a show where in the second half of the show that I'm doing, people have to write stuff on, like, pieces of paper. They have to, like, write notes, right? And there were pens and paper, like, on either side of the stage. And I was like, look, we're about to go into a break. In the break, you're going to write your stories. And the whole point is, like, they're supposed to come up to the stage and there's lots of pens for everybody they can write or whatever. And this woman took she took the pens and she took one and she started passing them along. And I was like, you're not – I didn't say give the pens to – I was like, oh, you're Canadian.
Shame. Oh, you're so, they really are nice.
Everybody started laughing at themselves. And, like, the I've had experiences like I'll give you a perfect example of Canadian politeness. I was in a public toilet, okay, and I was making a wee. Okay. And I was getting up from the toilet, okay, so pants down, right? The door opens. I didn't lock it properly by mistake. The door opens. There's a man standing there.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, the first thing you should do is immediately close that door. Like, you can see this. I was like, because I felt somebody, like, opening the handle, and I said out loud, like, it's busy, you know? Yeah. But it was too late. He opened the door. And in that moment, it's like, you're supposed to close the door, you know, very fast. But he was like, Sorry. And I'm like,
shame,
okay.
Man.
Yeah, let's go.
but like, I think the politeness was like, first I must say sorry, then close the door. You know, like, the robot brain could not stop him from, like, having that process.
That's so typical of
even catcalling, you know, like, sometimes you're walking down a street as a woman, like, you're walking down the street and you see guys walking towards you and you're like, I just know they're going to say some shit. I know the type. You have lots of people walking past you in the street, and every now and again, some guys will pass you, like, you know, right? You know when it's about to happen.
You can see them, and you're just like, okay. Am I going to be rude? Yes. Or am I going to be nice?
You're bracing yourself, and these guys walk past me, and sure enough, they open their mouths, and the thing they said to me was, hope you're having a great day.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. What you'd least expect.
And another one. I had another one. He was like, I walked past and he goes, excuse me, ma'am. And I'm like, what? Yeah. He goes, you've got beautiful hair.
Oh, wow. That's so nice. They're so nice. God damn it.
Polite perverts.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, wow. Thank you. Canada. Yeah, and you're preparing yourself for, like, a sour response because you're like, get away from me, you creep.
Yeah.
God, that's amazing.
Have a nice day.
So are you in South Africa for a little while now? What's the story?
I'm in South Africa until the second – I'm in South Africa until the 1st of August.
Oh,
and then
it's like a week.
Cape Town. That's my first.
Cape Town is not South. Oh. Cape Town is not South Africa. Okay.
No. So I spend one night in the country of Cape Town, and then I go to. On the second, I'm going back on tour for 2 weeks. I'm going to be in the UK. I'm going to be in Ireland and Scotland and London.
Wow. That's amazing. And, all right, so go and see Gilly in Cape Town for one night only, and then are you doing Joburg?
Don't go see Gilly in Cape Town. Come see Gilly in Joburg.
Okay, even better. Yeah. All right, yeah. Then you don't have to cross borders.
Shows, Gareth, there are two shows in Joburg, and let me tell you something. You guys were talking about. I watched Alan's sad little face when Gareth you. Started talking about basically how you despise the theatre.
Well, I'm a shit. I'm not the target market here. I mean, there are lots of brilliant people. I'm just a useless. I'm useless. But he doesn't listen to my podcast, and I'm not offended by that.
No, exactly.
Yeah, we're all putting out shit all the time. I mean, like, you didn't like my picture on Instagram. And I mean, Alan's been through a lot of change in the world of theatre and comedy, so he knows what he's dealing with here. And I mean, people like me are hardly likely to ruin his.
You talk about like people being like lazy to go to comedy and like go to theatre and go to stuff like that. It's only in South Africa. I can tell you, the shows overseas are very well attended. People are dying to go out to plays. They're dying to see comedy. If you stand on any London street outside any London club, there are like. The first time I saw that, it blew my mind. I mean, it was 2021, and I saw people waiting in line to watch comedy around the block, and they don't even know who they're seeing. I mean, so people go to the theater. I think it's a cultural thing.
I have a question.
I wish we would have more of that here.
My question is, do you think South Africans don't go because we're naturally funny? Like, every other person you meet can crack you up, and you're just like, why must I pay money to make you laugh? And therefore, like, overseas, it's not necessarily...
People say that about the Irish, and the Irish still go see shows, and the Brits also. I mean, the Brits are known for comedy. They all think they're hilarious. Every guy at a pub thinks he's the funniest man on earth. And still, those places are packed full of people watching comedy. So
that's great.
So I hear you, but I don't think that's the case. I think we just don't have a culture of like paying to see people in dark rooms. That's what I got. Like, I was in London, I was like, oh, these people have it in their bones for centuries to go sit in a dark room with lots of other people and watch something on a stage. It just is part of the culture, you know? Having said that, you know, I'm not asking for 10,000 people to come see my show. My shows are very small. They can only take about 50 people. So if 50 of you could please look at all these little comments. Gilly, you came back from Australia. Gilly, you come back. Can you please stop? Can you please just come to the show?
Come to the fucking show. She's not here for her health.
You won't regret it. It's hilarious. I'm very good at the moment.
No, you are, but like, you're exercising your comedy muscle like very few other people are, right? I mean, Alan, you'll also be able to witness this, that when you're doing a lot of stuff, you get better and better. It's when you take a break and when you are on a hiatus that you lose your ability to do the timing right, to get the words right, to say it, to read the faces. That stuff goes away.
Very quickly. And it's been, I mean, Gilly's a fine example of someone who works and works and works and works. And it's extraordinary watching her growth. She's incredible. She did a thing last year, no doubt you know about this, where she put out an Insta story every single day for the whole year. And at one point she was owning the fact that, oh, why did I ever start this madness and how hard it is. But the honest truth is, for those of us who did watch it, and I think I watched at least 70% of those stories, if not more, over the year, you could see how... she got more comfortable in front of the camera, and I know, because we've had this conversation, how much it's improved and helped her with her stand-up. This woman works, she watches stuff, she travels, she gets out, she puts herself out of her comfort zone. This is what you want in a comic, somebody who wants to be better and actually shows us that she is.
Well, that's why she's killing it. That's why she's going all over the world, and people are asking
all
for
over the world.
I just want to say that Gilly, we checked in with you on this show a couple of times, and I also watched your Instagram, which I still follow, and I saw all the stuff that you were doing. I couldn't believe the kind of output. That's tough to do. Yeah. So, I mean, if you're pushing yourself like that, then you're bound to become the best.
And Gareth, I have to tell you, it was an absolute nightmare.
Yeah, of course. Of course it was. This is the thing.
I hated every second of it. I want you all to know.
Everybody thinks that entertainment, whether it's doing a theatre show like Alan does, whether it's doing stand-up like the both of you do, whether it's doing the kind of stuff that Simpiwe and I do. Everybody thinks it's like it's fun and we love every minute of it. Of course, when things are flowing and when it's all working properly and you've put in the work and you've done the effort and you've made sure you've done some research or whatever it might be, you've perfected your little bit of the craft, then it looks great and it feels great too. But Jesus, those bad days, wow.
The 4 a.m. Trying to get me out of bed. Mm.
And I'm not asking for sympathy here. I mean, my audience could give a shit. They'll tell me to shut right up if I ask for sympathy. But the fact is, those bad days, you need something to get you through it. And it might be coffee. Yeah. It might be friends. It might be a drink. It might be just completely barricading yourself off and being a bit of a hermit for a little while, throwing yourself into books. It could be anything. I don't know what you guys do. What do you do, Gilly, when you need to kind of fill up, refresh?
You know what? I'm struggling to find that at the moment, because it used to be like, if I'm in a foreign place, like, oh, I get to go for like long walks, and it's, you know, because it's very nice. You know, one of the things that's very nice about being overseas is you can walk in the street and then not come back with all your belongings to where you started your walk. That's what I would do. That's what I would do to relax overseas. I'd stand in the street and just hold my phone out like this.
Oh man, yeah, that's get out there. What do you do, Alan?
Listen, the days off are hermit days. I try not to talk to anyone unless you know they're the closest people in your life, and even they know that you're not going to get a lot because you spend so much time being gregarious and putting energy out, and that does it depletes the pot. So you do need at least one day a week where you just try and chat. And whether that's just sleeping or watching mindless television or whatever, it's important.
All right, here's the info.
Oh, look at that. Wow.
She's so efficient. While she's talking to us, she's also typing. She said, come and watch my show, as if she's not in the room with us at the moment, at the Bioscope on the 23rd or 27th of July. Tickets at the link on my Instagram. Go and follow Gilly on Instagram and you will find
I can't listen to everything you guys say. With respect.
And you haven't.
Fair enough. No, definitely not. Listen, love you guys. You fill us up. You give us a reason to smile, even when inflation is high, petrol prices are killing us, Eskom switching on and off. It's always good to have a reason to laugh at ourselves and at the stuff that you guys come up with. So thank you for being on the show, both of you, this morning. All the details of Alan's show and of Gilly's appearances and shows, all of it will be on cliffcentral.com. You can follow the links to their social media for more. Simpiwe, we will see you tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. Have an excellent day, everybody. Get lots of shit done. Cheers. Bye-bye. Cliffcentral.com.